This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. If you're interested in movie westerns or American history, you should be very intrigued by the story our first guest has to tell. His name is S.C. Gwynn, and his nonfiction bestseller, now out in paperback, is about Quanah Parker, the last chief of the Comanches, which Gwynn describes as the most dominant and influential Indian tribe in American history. Quanah's mother, Cynthia Ann Parker, was a white woman who was kidnapped when she was 9 years old during a Comanche raid on her family's home in Texas. That was in 1836. She was raised by the Comanche as one of their own and had three children. When her eldest child, Quanah, was 12, Cynthia Ann was kidnapped back by Texas Rangers, but she kept trying to return to the Comanches. S.C. Gwynn's book, Empire of the Summer Moon, tells the story of Quanah and his mother. It also tells the larger story of the rise and fall of the Comanches and how their dominance in the middle of North America determined how the American West was opened. Gwynn is a former senior editor at Time Magazine and former executive editor of Texas Monthly. He's now with the Dallas Morning News. Terry spoke with him in 2010.
Sam Gwynn, welcome to Fresh Air. So let's start with the story of how Quanah's mother was captured by the Comanche when she was 9. I mean, the family lived in a fort on the outer edge of white settlements, about 90 miles from what is now Dallas. So they were very exposed. Why were they there?
They were part of that kind of vanguard of Scots-Irish settlement that really, you know, in effect was what eventually beat the Indians. But they were people who were determined. They were hard-nosed. They were predestinarian Baptists. And they settled, as you say, about 90 miles south of what is now Dallas. It was the outermost edge of the frontier. What they didn't know when they built their fort in 1836 was that it was right at the point where this giant 250,000-square-mile Comanche empire touched this nascent American empire. They were exactly at that point. And so the Comanches raided the fort in May of 1836, killed five people. There were a bunch of people wounded. Some escaped. But five captives were taken, and one of those captives was the 9-year-old Cynthia Ann Parker, which became then, in effect, the start of a 24-year-old captivity that she came to see not as captivity.
You describe very vividly what the Comanche raid on the Parker Fort was like, and it's gruesome.
Extremely.
So I'm going to ask you to describe it, but first I'll say, if you don't want to hear a gruesome description, this is your opportunity to tune out for maybe two minutes. Come right back. But, I mean, this is history. So I think it's very important and interesting history. So please describe what happened.
Well, what happened was what happened in every Plains Indian raid going back for centuries. In other words, this is what Indians did to Indians, and this has just happened to be Indians meeting whites. But the automatic thing in battle is all the adult males would be killed. That was automatic. That's one of the reasons that Indians fought to the death. The white men were astonished at it, but they were assumed that they would be killed. Most of the small children were killed, very small children were killed. A lot of the, say, children in the, I don't know, 3 to 7 or 3 to 10 range were often taken as captives. The women were often raped and often killed. And so it was an extremely brutal, in other words, when all the people in the settlements back in those years knew what it was, knew what a Comanche raid meant, which was the same as a Kiowa raid or an Arapaho raid or another kind of raid. But they were grim, they were grisly, captives were usually involved. And it's an interesting kind of moral question that you have to, as an historian about Plains Indians or about American Indians in general, you have to come to terms with this, with torture, which they practiced all across the West, in fact, all across the East, and these kind of grisly practices that scared white people to death.
I mean, you're talking not only about scalping, you're talking about various forms of mutilation, cutting off fingers and toes.
Torture by fire, torture by all sorts of different things. I mean, putting, you know, hot coals on your stomach. And I mean, there were lots and lots of imaginative tortures that were indeed practiced by Indians all across the Americas.
And this includes gang rape.
And includes gang rape.
And what I find provocative about this right now is that an American's attempt to reconcile the atrocities that Americans committed against Native Americans, a lot of the Indian story was maybe rewritten a little bit to leave out some of those atrocities. I mean, after
absolutely.
Focusing so much on, like, yes. you know, cowboys versus Indians in Western movies, I think so many Americans felt bad about that kind of, like, good guy versus bad guy description when white Americans were responsible for so much bad stuff themselves, that maybe – are you suggesting in your book that history maybe got rewritten a little too much in terms of leaving out some of the atrocities that
so.
Native Americans did commit in those wars?
I think that's a good point. And there was even an attempt at some point to deny that Indians were warlike. Comanches were incredibly warlike. They swept everyone off the southern plains. They nearly exterminated the Apaches. They were warlike by nature. And, you know, if you look at, say, the Comanches, and then you look back in history at for example, you know, Goths or Vikings or Mongols or Celts, or old Celts are actually a very good parallel. In a lot of ways, I think we're looking back at earlier versions of ourselves. In other words, we being white Europeans, did all those things. Not only that, but torture was institutionalized in things like the Counter-Reformation and the Spanish Inquisition. It was part of the Russian Empire. I mean, torture is not the exclusive province of the Indians. But I think you're right. I think there was a certain wave of books, a certain type of book that wanted to kind of set the record straight in a different way. But yes, life was extremely brutal, and it was extremely brutal on both sides. And in my book, I try not to take sides. The whites were perpetrators of some of the most astonishing massacres in history, but so were the Indians.
So in this raid in which Cynthia Ann Parker was taken captive, how many people were killed and who was taken captive?
There were five people killed, and there were five captives taken. And the five captives were two young adult women and three children, two boys, and then Cynthia Ann. So there were the five, and they were kind of strapped to horses and, you know, taken north into the vast, grassy wastes of the plains.
Why were the women taken and the children?
As it turns out, if you can sort of look back on what happened to them. One of the captives, Rachel Parker Plummer, who became very famous because she wrote a memoir of 15 months of captivity, she was actually kind of taken on as a what amounted to a slave. And Indians, Plains Indians, were buffalo-based, and they needed women actually to work buffalo hides. This was a part of the economy. So that's what Rachel did. Now, Elizabeth Kellogg, who was the other adult captive, was ransomed back within about 3 months. And that showed another way or another reason for taking a captive is there was a trade. There was a commerce in captives. The three younger children were actually adopted into the tribe, and this was a very common Comanche practice. The Comanches were had high mortality rates among the men and low fertility rates among the women, and they actually needed people. So they were more or less indiscriminate in who they took in. So there were Apache captives and Mexican captives and various types of captives that, you know, many of whom grew to become part of the Comanche tribe. Cynthia Ann was one of them. So she was a loved captive. She had a family. She became the ward of a chief. She became a fully fledged member of the Comanche community.
So Cynthia Ann had three children, the oldest of which, Quanah, became one of the fiercest and most respected Comanche war chiefs. How did he become a warrior? I guess, are you automatically a warrior if you're a male Comanche in that period?
Oh, yes, you are. You were. The Comanches were kind of like the Spartans. They were, because of their incredible mastery, military mastery, which derived from the horse. They were the prototype horse tribe, the tribe that could do more with the horse than any other tribe could. Because of that, it was a military community, and their old way of life was supplanted by the new way of life, which was largely to do with war. So they pretty much hunted buffalo, and so a Comanche male would hunt buffalo and made war, and that's what they did. And they were remarkably stripped down in the sense that they didn't have elaborate social organization or religious organization. They didn't weave baskets or do art. They had a very, very elemental culture. And so within that culture, the boys learned to hunt at a very hunt and ride at a very early age, and then would become a warrior in their mid-teens. So he had kind of a normal a normal rise, except that he was an exceptional warrior.
Now, did being half white affect his standing within the Comanche?
It did. Until he was 12, when his father was killed, an interesting event happened when Quanah was 12. And until that point, he was the son of a chief, a powerful chief who would have had many horses and would have been, you know, wealthy in Comanche terms. And then at the Battle of Peace River in 1860, when Cynthia Ann was recaptured, Quanah's father was killed. And now he was an orphan. His mother was back with white society, and his father was dead. And at that point, yes, he paid a price for having white blood. It probably stood him in good stead later in life, after in the reservation period. But then I think it was hard, and Quanah compensated for that, becoming probably the most capable warrior of his era.
Tell us the story of how Cynthia Ann was kidnapped back by white people in 1860 when Quanah was
This was an amazing story. When she had to back up to when she was kidnapped in 1836, in the 1840s, she was spotted a few times, and each time she was spotted, the people that saw it were usually Indian agents, tried to negotiate to get her back. This was kind of a set piece on the frontier. You try to get the hostage, the captive back. When they figured out that she didn't want to come back, and she refused to come back. And this is the first kind of her first fame was built on that. She was the white squaw who would not return. She sort of fades from memory in the 50s. She's no longer seen. Then in 1860, this extraordinary event happens. Her husband, Cynthia Ann's husband, Peter Nakona, is raiding just west of Fort Worth. He's leading these incredibly brutal raids that have a political purpose, which is basically to roll the frontier backward. They're so brutal that the white men kind of get a posse together under a guy named Sol Ross, who was later governor of Texas, under another guy named Charles Goodnight, who was one of the more famous cattlemen later in Texas. And they pursue the Indians back to what amounts to the camp where Cynthia Ann and her husband are. At that moment, most of the men were not at the camp, and so the rangers attack and they kill everybody, including Quanah's father. And as Sol Ross literally is running down the last Indian and about to shoot, he realizes the Indian has a child, then realizes the Indian's a woman, and then realizes that the Indian has blue eyes. And lo and behold, soon enough, they realize that he's recaptured the famous Cynthia Ann Parker, who indeed then becomes famous again for having been recaptured. It was curious because the white men all thought that the tragedy of Cynthia Ann's life was that she had been captured the first time by the Indians. In fact, the great tragedy of her life was that she was captured the second time by the whites because she never adjusted. She tried to escape for the rest of her life and never adjusted. She had adapted once brilliantly to a foreign culture, but she couldn't do it twice.
So where did she live?
Well, after she was captured, the first thing that happened is they took her to Fort Worth and they literally put her up on a stand where people could come and gawk at her because she was such an object of curiosity. She had her 2-year-old, half white Indian child with her, Prairie Flower, and she ended up at the house of her uncle near Fort Worth, and she kept trying to escape, and she mourned and she wept and she cut herself and she. I mean, she simply was a lot to handle. And so Isaac, that uncle, Isaac Parker, then moved her to another group of relatives and then on to and then she was eventually moved to another group of relatives deeper into East Texas, away from the plains. She was always a handful. She eventually kind of settled down a little bit, but she never stopped trying to escape.
So when Quanah grew up and became a warrior, did he want revenge against the white people who had taken back his mother?
Yes, no one burned hotter than Quanah did. Quanah later became famous during the reservation period as a very wealthy and successful and influential Indian. But he never talked about what he did. We can sort of theorize the kind of raids he was on. We knew where the Comanches were raiding during the years when he was in his late teens and early 20s. The raids were particularly brutal. He was known as a brilliant fighter of both Indians and whites. He was someone who was never defeated in battle, and it was sort of the source of his fame.
To give us a visual image of what Quanah looked like, I want you to read something from your book that is from the journal of someone from the army who fought against him. So granted, this is a very, very kind of biased description of him because it's from an army person fighting against Quanah. But tell us who wrote this and then read the paragraph.
Okay, the account is from Robert Carter, who actually won the Medal of Honor for this fight against Quanah in 1871. And Carter wrote memoirs, a really extraordinary memoir, and it offers us one of the best looks at Quanah. This particular description comes from the Battle of Blanco Canyon, where Quanah did something that I don't know that there's any precedent for in military history, where Quanah, in effect, took an entire village of 200 lodges and hundreds of people and women and children and dogs and led it on an escape from 600 mounted bluecoats. It was a piece of military maneuvering. As I say, I don't think it's ever been done before. But anyway, this was the beginning. The beginning of that was sort of a battle. The beginning of that escape was a battle. And this is what Robert Carter is describing. He's describing actually Quanah just at the moment that Quanah blows the brains out of one of his sergeants. So here we go. A large and powerfully built chief led the bunch on a coal black racing pony. Leaning forward upon his mane, his heels nervously working in the animal's side, with six-shooter poised in the air, he seemed the incarnation of savage, brutal joy. His face was smeared with black war paint, which gave his features a satanic look, a full-length headdress or war bonnet of eagle's feathers spreading out as he rode and descending from his forehead, overhead and back, to his pony's tail, almost swept the ground. Large brass hoops were in his ears. He was naked to the waist, wearing simply leggings, moccasins, and a breech clout. A necklace of bear's claws hung about his neck. Bells jingled as he rode at headlong speed, followed by the leading warriors, all eager to outstrip him in the race. It was Quanah, the principal war chief of the Quahadas.
So did Quanah go on raids? Did he lead raids on white settlements that were as brutal as the raid on his mother's family?
Absolutely. And you have to understand that raiding is what Mounted Plains Indians did. That was their, in effect, the Comanche way of life. They didn't, you know, they didn't really fight in the traditional way. They weren't, when they fought the white man, they did not usually, you know, draw themselves up in ranks of 1,000 with gleaming spears against them and charge. That really didn't happen. Most of the warfare was what we would call sort of guerrilla warfare. These were attacks on ranches and things like that in settlements. So yes, this is what Quanah did. The idea was to improve your stock or increase your stock, you know, get more horses, eventually also cows. The idea was also to get scalps, and simply the way of Comanche life. There was, you know, a traditional way of the raid was to you know, go steal as many horses as you could and so forth. Eventually, it acquired more of a political cast. As the frontier swept westward through Texas, you know, the Comanches at some point realized that there was more to raiding than simply stealing cattle. They were making a political statement. They were, in effect, you know, the more brutal the raids were, the more the frontier rolled backward.
Now, so you say between 1868 and 1881, 31 million buffalo were slaughtered, and that destroyed the source of Comanche wealth and food. So was that the downfall of the Comanche, the slaughtering?
It was
the
pretty much, you know, the Plains Indians, their lives were built with the Comanches. Their lives were built on two things, really. It was war and buffalo. And really all of the Plains Indians, once they got the horse from the Spanish, you know, buffalo hunting became easier for them. It was their way of life. The buffalo hunting began as a simple market exercise. I mean, the hunters figured out that they could get $3.50 a hide, and they figured out that they could ship these hides east on the new railroads. And they also figured out that buffalo were not smart enough to realize that if a buffalo next to the buffalo dropped, that there was something wrong. The buffalo had to see the source of the danger, so that you had these people who killed like 3,500 buffalo in 28 days and crazy numbers like that. But it started that way, but it ended up being a political act because the United States could have done something about that probably. But it occurred to the generals in the West, specifically Sherman and Sheridan, that by allowing the buffalo to be destroyed, they were creating kind of the most efficient way to destroy Indians. And Sheridan had a famous quote. He said, you know, you kill the buffalo, you destroy the Indians' commissary. So it became, in a way, political at the end. Yes, let's kill all the buffalo, and then it's the end of Plains Indians, because there is no Plains Indian without a buffalo.
So how did Quanah decide to give up fighting and settle for a land deal with the U.S. government?
Quanah, in 1875, after something called the Red River War, in which Quanah, again, miraculously evaded capture and didn't lose any battles, Quanah led the last of the Comanches who were starving, and of course they were starving because there was no buffalo, the last of the starving Comanches. They were the last ones to surrender in 1875. They came onto a reservation in Oklahoma. Quanah, who had been, as I said before, like the hardest of the hard cases, the one who burned hottest for revenge against the whites, had sort of a revelation. His family lore says it was a vision that with a wolf and an eagle in it, but something happened and changed, and he decided he would walk the white man's road, and he decided it as he was coming into the reservation.
What do you mean, walk the white man's road?
Well, he would become, in fact, you know, Quanah, the notion seems almost ridiculous of a bourgeois kind of Comanche, citizen Comanche, but that's what Quanah wanted to be. Quanah was going to walk the white man's road. In other words, try to learn the language, try to understand white man's business. He actually turned out to be a brilliant businessman, controlled a small cattle empire, outfoxed the whites at their own cattle leasing games. Actually ran these kind of protection rackets for a while. He was actually a brilliant businessman, but he just figured he would adapt, and he would try to help his tribe adapt. And of all the Indians in the reservation period, he was the wealthiest and most influential. He became a friend of Teddy Roosevelt and rode in his inaugural parade and so forth.
So during this period, was he not only aware, but did he make other people aware that he was half white? Did he use that to work in his favor when trying to deal with white people?
That became known right after Quanah surrendered. He went into the commandant at Fort Sill, and he told him, because what Quanah wanted to know was what had happened to his mother. Quanah's first question was, what happened to my mother? And that's how, in other words, as soon as that happened, everybody found out.
And what had happened to his mother? Was she already dead?
Cynthia Ann leads this kind of miserable life, shuffled off to, you know, one Parker relative after another, pretty miserable. In 1864, she lost her daughter to influenza, this lovely little girl named Prairie Flower. In 1870, she herself died, and it's not exactly clear how or why. Some said she starved herself to death. Some people said she died of a broken heart, but either way, she never adapted, so that it was a tragedy, I guess part of that family tragedy, that Cynthia Ann died in 1870, and her son, Quanah, did not come into surrender until 1875. So he never saw his mother again, although he spent enormous efforts trying to find her, and eventually did find her, and eventually got the government to pay to ship her bones up to lie with his in Oklahoma.
So how do you see American history differently as a result of researching this book?
To me, the original reason I was interested was because it provided, the Comanches were kind of a history lesson. They were sort of, here is how and why the middle of the country opened to white civilization. If you go back through Comanche history, you can see that they were the ones who stopped the Spanish from coming north. They answered to that question. Why did the French stop coming west from Louisiana? Comanches. It was fear of the Comanches that caused the Mexicans to bring white Texas settlers into Texas, you know, to create a buffer between them and the Comanches, which eventually backfired. And, of course, Texas became a republic, and things like the Alamo and San Jacinto happened. I mean, they account for, you know, the Rangers and the Six Gun and so many different things. And to me, what I came away understanding from the Comanches was that here is why the West Coast and the East Coast settled before the middle of the continent did. Here is why there was this enormous, basically 40-year wait before you could develop the state of Texas, or before other plains states could be developed. So it was kind of a great history lesson in how America settled itself, I guess.
Sam Gwynn, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, you're welcome, Terry. I really enjoyed it.
S.C. Gwynn speaking to Terry Gross in 2010. His book, Empire of the Summer Moon, is now out in paperback. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Our next guest, country artist Jimmy Dale Gilmore, has a new CD with the band The Wronglers. It's titled Heirloom Music and features fresh versions of old-timey tunes dating back to the 30s and 40s. As a songwriter and singer, Jimmy Dale Gilmore is considered part of the alternative country music scene. He grew up in Lubbock, Texas, and his new CD is full of songs he'd heard and played most of his life. They're songs from an earlier era, associated with such country icons as Bill Monroe, Charlie Poole, and the Carter family. Terry spoke with Jimmy Dale Gilmore earlier this year, just before he and the Wronglers performed songs from heirloom music at the South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin, which Gilmore considers his adopted hometown. But before we hear their conversation, let's listen to the opening track from Heirloom Music, a song called Time Changes Everything.
Had our fun, but time changes everything. When you left me, my poor heart was broken. Our romance seemed all in vain. But the dark clouds are gone, and there's blue skies again. 'Cause time changes everything.
Jimmy Dale Gilmore, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's such a pleasure to have you back. I love the new record. Is there a story behind why you chose Time Changes Everything?
Well, it's funny, because we kind of were thinking in the realm of bluegrass with this record, although that's not exactly what it is, really. It's not the accurate description. That song had been a real favorite of mine from a lot of different directions, and I found a recording of it by Bill Monroe that I didn't even know about. I never had associated that. That's a Western swing. You know, it's a, I think Tommy Duncan wrote it.
From the Bob Wills band.
Yeah. The Bob Wills version was the one that I first knew, you know, as a kid. And then the one that I actually learned it from, though, was Johnny Cash.
Really?
There was a collection that, I think it was called Now There Was a Song. And it was my dad's favorite. Well, he had two favorite records. He had that one and a collection by Marty Robbins of same kind of thing, you know, cover songs, where they had done old cover songs. And Time Changes Everything, you know, I've heard it in many, many different versions. It's just always so funny because it's self-referential. And when you hear, you know, you can change the words of an old tune.
So you said that bluegrass would not be an accurate description of this album, even though you kind of set out to make a bluegrass album. So what would an accurate description be?
Well, you know, we were calling it old-timey music, but that has kind of acquired a ring, you know, it still wasn't quite accurate. And Warren Hellman had said that somebody had referred to all of this sort of music as heirloom music. And I loved that phrase. There's something about that old-timey sort of, you know, there's something dismissive about it. And kind of part of our point in all this was that this music is old, but it's really good, really still pertinent.
Well, let's hear another song from the new album. And this is a Charlie Poole song, or at least I don't know if he wrote it, but his recording is certainly the first famous one. And the song's called Leaving Home. So tell us how you learned the song and what the song means to you.
Well, I very first heard it from the New Lost City Ramblers. And, well, I just fell in love with the song because it's just so peculiar and quirky. And as a result of hearing that, I went and looked further into it, and it caused me to discover some of that really older stuff, their source material. And the Charlie Poole one is still one of the strangest recordings. And I think my recording of it is somewhat true to the original. You know, this Frankie and Johnny theme, there was probably 100 different versions of Frankie and Johnny, and this is a different version, but it's so extremely different that it veered off into another world, I think.
So this is Jimmy Dale Gilmore and the Wronglers from their new album, Heirloom Music.
Well, Frankie said to her, Johnny, now your hour done come, 'cause underneath her silk kimono she drew a 44 gun. These love affairs are hard to bear. Johnny, he fled down the stairway. My love, Frankie, don't shoot. Frankie done aimed that 44 and the gun went rooty toot toot. Johnny fell. Then Frankie yelled, I'm going away, I'm going to stay and never coming home. You're gonna miss me, honey, in the days to come. When the wind begins to blow, the ground is covered up. And when you think of the way you're gonna want me back, your loving man, you're gonna miss me, honey, in the day they say to come.
So in talking about your musical past, the last time you were on the show, you performed songs that you learned through your father. Country songs, and he used to play in a country band, although he worked at a university where he was the director of a dairy lab. Do I have that right?
Yeah, the dairy industry department, they called it. It later on became the food technologies department.
Well, so he had two really different sides of his life, music and his academic career.
Right.
And while we're on the subject, you went to Texas Tech where he worked. You went there briefly? Is that the right word?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I went for a couple of years. And I actually, I studied a couple of things pretty intensively, but I never did get a degree. I made really good grades in philosophy and anthropology, but I was already beginning to spend too much time in the nightlife, the honky-tonks, and, you know, the bootleg joints and stuff.
Bootleg?
To be able to handle college.
Literally bootleg?
Oh, yeah. Lubbock was, until very recently, was dry. You know, and Lubbock's a fairly large town. I mean, it's not a village. It's close to a couple of 100,000 people. University town, but it was dry. So any of the nightlife, you know, that involved alcohol was illegal. As a matter of fact, Joe Ely and I got to be friends because we met each other because we both played at some of these places that were, not only was it illegal for us to be there at the age we were, actually there were no age restrictions because the entire thing was illegal.
Right.
So that was part of the backdrop. And then I had a group of friends that were I sort of lived in these two different worlds at the time. I had a lot of like intellectual and creative, you know, music and artists and writers and, you know, kind of university sort of people. And then I had this other group of friends because of that music nightlife stuff that were professional gamblers. and I hung out with them a lot, and that's where I never could play cards or anything. I was terrible. But I played music. I just hung around with these guys and played music, and I took requests from them. That's how I grew a lot of my repertoire, a lot of songs that I knew a little bit. These guys would want me to sing them, and so I'd learn them. That's how I ended up knowing so many Hank Williams songs and, you know, Johnny Cash, that sort of stuff.
Would you describe one of the bootleg joints that you played in?
Well, they were really, basically, they were just little dark bars, sort of like a cross between a bar and a coffee house. And the only thing is that at any time it might be raided.
Were you ever raided?
You know, I never did happen to be there when one of the raids happened. And, of course, later on, you know, that world sort of blended real easily into the drug world when that happened. You know,
I was just thinking about that. Like, you're playing at these bootleg joints, right, probably right on the verge of the era when a lot of young people were not only smoking marijuana but doing psychedelic drugs.
That's exactly
yeah.
That's exactly what happened. There came to be this convergence of these groups of people. You know, the the intellectual crowd I was talking about that also, you know, were music lovers and not life people, some of them.
So you must have felt like you were in two completely different worlds at the same time.
I did. I always had a schizophrenic feeling about my social position. I talked about that on, I think on After a While, that was my first actual major label record. I talked about having an epiphany one time when I read a phrase by Ezra Pound, because I was so much into country music, and most of my friends weren't. They really only liked rock and roll at the time, top 40 kind of stuff. But I read this thing by Ezra Pound where he said, the poem fails when it strays too far from the song, and the song fails when it strays too far from the dance. And I loved that. I loved that so much. And for some reason, that had the effect of, like, bringing my two worlds together in my own head. You know, that honky-tonk music was dance music. It was almost like that, like Ezra Pound giving the intellectuals endorsement to this, you know, this lowbrow kind of music.
So I have a suggestion for your next record, and I'm sure you'll want to do it since I suggested it. You want to know what it is?
All right.
You ready?
Sure.
Okay, so it's an album of cowboy songs. And I'm
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because I love that stuff, and I'm suggesting it in part because I hear this affinity, this connection between your voice and Gene Autry's voice. Do you like Gene Autry?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, you know, there's an interesting link between us. My great aunt, I never did know her, but my dad's aunt, actually, she was from Tioga, Texas. They always called it Tioga. And I remember that because it came up in a conversation I had with Colonel Tom Parker one time, who I didn't realize had been Gene Autry's manager.
This is the guy who was Elvis's manager.
Yes, yes. Colonel Tom Parker had his history was even more amazing than most people know about. And he remembered that Gene Autry was from Tioga, Texas. You know, it's like my relatives, you know, the East Texas kind of people. You know, it's like they say Noe instead of Noah. Anyway, my aunt actually sort of helped raise Gene Autry.
No.
Yeah. Apparently, her son, who would have been my dad's cousin, who also I don't know, I never have met, but apparently they were best friends, and Gene Autry lived with them a lot. I think he was, I don't really know the details of the background to all of it, you know, but apparently he was closer to their family than he was to his own. And my dad said that my aunt told him one time that she played Gene Autry his first Jimmy Rogers records.
Wow, because his early songs were really influenced by Jimmy Rogers.
Yes, and in the early days, he was an outright imitator of Jimmy Rogers.
And he yodeled.
He sounded just exactly like him, yeah.
Wow. So did you grow up hearing Gene Autry records because of this family connection?
Well, I didn't know the family connection until many, many years later. That was just a little story that came up somewhere around the supper table one time. Long time later.
But did you hear his records?
I loved Gene Autry when I was a little kid. I had that little, red vinyl record of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and the flip side was Frosty the Snowman by Gene Autry.
Mm-hmm.
And that was way, and I was in the first grade, I think. And I really loved Gene Autry, although later on, you know, I kind of veered more towards the blues and the honky-tonk music was more appealing to me than that sort of movie cowboy music.
Well, Jimmy Dale Gilmore, it's been great to talk with you, and I really want to thank you a lot.
Well, thank you, Terry, and it's so much fun to get to actually talk with you instead of just listen to you, because I hear you just about every day.
Oh, that's so great. I'm so glad you listen.
Jimmy Dale Gilmore speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. His new CD with the Wranglers, Heirloom Music, has just been released. Keeping to his extraordinary pace of making a film a year, Woody Allen returns with a new comedy called Midnight in Paris, which arrives in the U.S. after premiering at this year's Cannes Film Festival. The movie stars Owen Wilson as a screenwriter visiting Paris who magically travels back in time to meet his artistic heroes of the 1920s. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Woody Allen isn't religious, but he has a rabbinical side. And over the last decade, his films have become more and more like Talmudic parables for atheists. On the surface, these movies are streamlined, even breezy, and they often have voiceover narration to get the pesky exposition out of the way fast. Philosophically, Allen has settled on resignation, a cosmic shrug. There's no God, no justice, people are inconstant, life is meaningless, so where do you want to eat? I have a problem, though, buying into the worldview of someone whose world is a closed ecosystem. There's no evidence that Allen lets any contemporary culture penetrate his hard defensive shell. Music stopped in the 40s, if not earlier. Ditto literature, ditto film, with a pass for select European directors. He seems locked in a daydream of the past. The good news is that Allen has made the lure of nostalgia the theme of his supernatural comedy Midnight in Paris, which might be why this is his best, most emotionally pure film in over a decade. It's a romantic fantasy that's also a sly act of self-criticism. The time-traveling hero, Gil, played by Owen Wilson, is a successful Hollywood screenwriter on holiday in Paris with his brisk, upwardly mobile fiancée, Inez, played by Rachel McAdams. Gil considers himself a hack and, to Inez's horror, wants to write novels instead of movies. How he wishes he could be a writer in Paris. Better yet, Paris in the 20s, alongside Scott and Zelda, Hemingway, Gertrude Stein, and all those other giants living high yet creating enduring works of art. It would certainly be preferable to being a tourist in Paris with Inez and her old professor, Paul.
I hope you're not going to be as antisocial tomorrow at Versailles.
How was I antisocial?
Oh, please. I mean, you could totally tell you didn't want to go.
Well, I mean, they're your friends, and I have to admit, I'm not quite as taken with him as you are.
He's brilliant. You know, I had such a crush on him in college, and Carol's very bright.
I mean, he's a pseudo-intellectual, just a little bit.
Gil, I hardly think he'd be lecturing at the Sorbonne if he's a pseudo-intellectual.
You can almost hear the familiar Woody Allen cadences, yet Owen Wilson isn't the usual East Coast intellectual Allen hero, and he makes the lines his own. Apart from Mia Farrow's in The Purple Rose of Cairo, this is the finest lead performance in an Allen film that wasn't by Allen, and finer than many of Allen's, too. You sense the vein of wistfulness under his stoner cool, the longing for definition behind his spaciness. It's a thrilling moment when he sits forlornly on some steps in the rain at midnight. A vintage automobile rumbles by. The champagne-swilling occupants invite him in, and he's suddenly back in the 20s. How? No explanation. Allen just breezes past all that the way he did in Purple Rose, and before that in his great 70s short story, The Kugelmass Episode, happily eliminating the sci-fi wheels and pulleys that tend to suck up so much screen time. Gil is just there, counseling Scott about Zelda, drinking with Hemingway, showing parts of his novel to Gertrude Stein, and falling in love with a woman named Adriana, played by a stunningly beautiful Marion Cotillard. Adriana bonds with Gil over his love of the past, except the past she loves is the 1890s, and not her vulgar present. His 20s ideal woman hates the 20s, a bitter irony. Allen doesn't do anything particularly interesting with Scott and Zelda. My guess is he's too in awe of them. But as Hemingway, played with forthright manly manliness by Corey Stoll, is a riot. And as Gertrude Stein, Kathy Bates proves that in an absurd context, playing it straight can make you funnier than a thousand clowns. Midnight in Paris is a doodle, but it's easy and graceful, and its ambivalent view of nostalgia has all kinds of resonance. As I watched, I felt a different sort of nostalgia, not for the Parisian 20s, but the days in which Allen regularly turned out freewheeling, pitch-perfect tall tales in print and on screen. The movie is so good, it takes you back to those days, which were the days, my friend.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hersfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.